Welcome back to Beyond Packaging, where we break down the forces shaping packaging and everything between. I'm Laura Foti.
I'm Matthew Wright, the co-host, and have not been fired yet. Today, we're going to talk about something near and dear to my heart, corrugated. And we have a great guest with us today, Laura.
We do. We're also coming to you live from, I think we're in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Close.
And we're joined by Ryan Fox, Bloomberg's Intelligence. Bloomberg Intelligence is corrugated marketing analyst to talk tariffs, box pricing, and the future of the industry. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
For those of you who don't know Ryan, very impressive background. I'd like to introduce him. He spent 10 years in packaging sales before jumping into industry reporting in 2020 with Bloomberg's Green Markets. In 2022, he joined Bloomberg Intelligence as its corrugated market analyst while remaining managing editor of the Green Markets Box Report. The monthly publication draws on insights from hundreds of packaging professionals to offer a unique forward-looking synopsis of box producer sentiment surrounding box demand. His content can be found on the Bloomberg Terminal and in the Green Markets Box Report. Those interested in packaging trends, which are many of our listeners, might be familiar with some of Ryan's work around corrugated recycling rates, which was highlighted in trade publications like Recycling Today, Resource Recycling, and Packaging Dive. Following his presentation of recycling data, the American Forest and Paper Association revised its methodology, lowering the reported recycling rate from 93% to the low 70% range. This is someone who can move the industry.
Wow. Yeah, thanks. Surprisingly, no one put a hit out on me yet. So
I was thinking that just over here.
Yep. I think it daily.
How did that come about, Ryan?
Which part? The hit or the
how did you figure out?
Okay, so in
briefly,
yeah, during the pandemic, I noticed that there were a lot of boxes on just my street, and even this week when we had trash day, there were so many boxes in the trash. And I contacted the FMPA. I was like, listen, I know you say 93% of boxes get recycled, and that's how they were advertising that 93% of boxes are recycled in the US. And I said, this doesn't feel right. Like, I'm just walking down my street and there is just boxes everywhere. And if this is one street in America, something's not right. And I asked them if we could talk about it. And they said, listen, it's the rate. It is what it is. We're not really going to get into it. And I said, okay, well, if there's no transparency, then I'm going to create it. And that's the Bloomberg way. In 1981, Mike Bloomberg started this company to help with transparency. And so every time we get into a market, that's what we do. We talk about transparency and bring data and bring it quickly. So I did the research. I partnered with some industry professionals to kind of find the real truth behind like how much is actually getting recycled. And the truth is that it's a lot less than 93%. And our data right now says it's in the mid 60s. We do think it's lower than that. We just don't have the data to prove it.
Well, we're big believers of data here. There's also a lot of news going on in the packaging industry right now. One thing we wanted to bring you on to talk about, Ryan, are tariffs. Yeah. Everyone's talking about this. I'm hearing that it's kind of a hair on fire for a lot of people in the industry.
What are you trying to say, Laura?
The Budget Lab at Yale University has been tracking this closely. Here's kind of a highlight of where some things stand. And this was as April 15th. There's a 20% broad tariff on all Chinese imports, 10% on Canadian potash and energy, 25% tariff on all Mexican imports and other Canadian imports, 25% tariff on all automobiles with the exemption of U.S. content, 25% tariff on steel and aluminum. I actually think this is already outdated given all the retaliatory tariffs, but it's pretty unbelievable. You know, Ryan, I know the reality for the packaging industry is more nuanced. Can you explain how this is impacting different sectors of the business?
Sure. I will tell you, when it comes to tariffs, this stuff is changing sometimes daily. I have spoken with Resource Recycling about this, and I mentioned in the course of our interview, I said, this stuff is changing daily. So this is what we know right now. They published the article, and by the end of the day, it had changed. So we do expect this everything to change right now when it comes to paper packaging. Paper coming into the U.S. from Canada is not tariffed. Pulp coming into the U.S. from Canada is not tariffed either. However, paper coming in from Europe or other countries is going to be subject to a tariff. Now, that's small potatoes. We import about 1.5 million tons of paper in the containerboard space a year. So it's not something that's really going to move the market terribly. It's going to be an inconvenience for some, but not anything big right now. The bigger thing with tariffs is that it creates uncertainty for businesses. It doesn't matter what business you want, certainty and having some sense that you can look into the future and feel like, okay, we have a game plan. We know what sales are going to do. We can plan appropriately. All of that went away. So had the administration done something like, we're going to do tariffs, we're in, there's no changes, probably would have gone over a lot better than this on again, off again, on again, off again. We're going to change it. We're not going to change it. We're going to change it. All of that uncertainty really stifled businesses. It spooked them. They scared, like they had no idea what to expect. So when you think about, production planning, if your future sales are kind of foggy at best, you're going to kind of halt a lot of the other buying unless you feel like that thing that you're buying is exposed to tariffs. Well, because boxes are made so locally, they're really not exposed to tariffs. I guess the exception would be is if you're making boxes and selling them over the border, which we do a lot of that in the US, but that's again pretty small in the grand scheme of things. But it's just that stifling of the manufacturing and that just broad pullback in what they're doing and their activities. We've seen it. We've seen a massive pullback so far. We think box shipments in the first quarter are actually going to be down at least 1.5%, maybe 2%. It actually could be higher, but we'll get the data next week. Sentiments have moved. We put a chart up on LinkedIn last week where we showed a 300 basis point swing in sentiment, which is pretty significant. We were, I think most people were expecting that with this new administration, that there was going to be some pro-business policy, that they were going to see a really great year, a rebound from a not so great year last year with boxes. And right now it seems like it's going to go the other direction.
Yeah. But maybe the tariffs, not a total catastrophe for the box industry, but Matthew, the packaging industry is certainly much larger than that. Can you speak to what you're hearing?
Yeah. And I think to Ryan's point, the point about corrugated packaging is it cubes out before it weights out, and that makes it very expensive to ship. And so, historically it's a 200-mile radius kind of product, depending on obviously the geo region you're in. But if you think about packaging that nests well, that waits before it cubes, that is packaging that historically is coming in from China and other countries. And one industry particular that really relies on that supply chain is the cosmetic industry. If you think about packaging in terms of a lipstick holder or any sort of mascara holder, that's packaging. And that by and large is coming from overseas. Obviously, you can fit a lot in a container, so it makes it economical. The infrastructure is not really here to produce that type of product. And so that product's definitely going to get challenged by the tariffs. And on top of that, generally, that's a pretty cost competitive item. So there's going to be certain industries, clamshell, as you can imagine, is massive today in agriculture. That also comes in a lot from overseas and nests very well. So I think, as Ryan says, if you look at the corrugated shipping box market, probably not highly impacted, but everything that goes into that box is going to be highly impacted. And that's back to data, why you really have to be able to slice and dice everything that you're buying, where it's coming from, and understanding these moving elements from regulatory to tariffs.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we talk about at Beyond Packaging is we go exactly that, beyond it. Can you talk about the tariff impacts on the actual products and what that's going to be like?
Yeah, to Ryan's point, not only do businesses like stability, businesses like predictability kind of going forward and using the rearview mirror to kind of predict that, that's gone right at the moment. And then on top of that, which makes it highly complex, is most products that are complex are coming from multi-countries and bringing that together either in some componentry or being assembled here. And that's what makes it challenging, because pieces of a product are coming from different parts of the world. And now with moving tariffs or moving fees on top of that complexity, it's just going to make it even more difficult. I know a big conversation that's coming up in customers is, can I have an ability to visualize the cost differences by country coming in so I can make decisions. And as you guys both alluded to, these numbers keep changing, right? So what may be good today might literally not be good tomorrow, and you have to make a different decision.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was looking, you know, it's so funny. I'm doing my executive MBA with all my free time, and my first economics class, this was last year, the professor's like, there's only one thing you need to know in economics. And he's like, tariffs don't work. And I'm like, wow, this is such a recent learning. You know, prices always get passed on a consumer. It's really not beneficial. It's really, you know, that was the big takeaway. But I was thinking about how do they actually work? Because when things change every day, you know, it literally is a ship comes into port, and that day, that's what you're paying. And so this idea of predictability, you're looking at future shipments and you don't know if it's going to be the same cost. So it is absolutely, my point being, businesses can't just sit and wait. They can't sit and wait for things to change because this is impacting them on a daily basis.
Right. Yeah, it's a global economy, and the supply chain is global. And we realized this first and foremost during the pandemic when everything just self destructed. I think we've done a really good job of trying to nearshore and reshore. One of the biggest problems we have right now is there are still well over 400,000 open manufacturing jobs in the U.S. So to think that we're just going to reshore and really quickly, that dog don't hunt, as they say here in the South. It's just not going to happen. We're going to see at least a 3 to 5 year window to get some of this stuff back. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, all these tariffs are really against our top three trade partner, you know, Mexico, Canada, China. It's where we get everything. And this has been the case for almost 30 years now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think to Ryan's point, the piece that you said when you started out was just so applicable, and people don't really understand the supply chain. And it's not, we think of that word in logistics terms typically, but irregardless of why manufacturing went different parts of the world, they've built these really integral supply chains that have raw material going to converters, converters going to further converters. And that's a really challenging thing to duplicate quickly. And a lot of people don't realize that's just not possible to do overnight.
Correct. When I was in the packaging business, I had customers who made products that were injection molded plastic, a variety of different things. And many of them sourced their parts from China. They did it for a number of reasons. One of the biggest reasons was that the Chinese economy was set up in such a way that they could do it quickly and do it very affordably. I remember one of my customers was telling me their part, if they were to have made it in the U.S., the tooling required would have been well over $100,000. But in China, they could do it for about $10,000. Right. And they could do it almost that much more quickly, too.
Well, the other thing you talked about, too, is the workforce challenge. And Matthew, this is something I know you're really passionate about. You know, given there, you know, there are opportunities. I always think, what is it? You never waste a good crisis, or crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Maybe there's nearshoring opportunities. Can you talk a little bit though about how companies can think about the workforce part?
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's a topic that I'm always passionate about, as you know, and Ryan nailed it on the head. And I think those numbers are even bigger than we probably understand. And the number one thing, I have a lot of friends in the manufacturing space, and the number one issue they have is getting human capital, right? And so, and you can have debates about that, but in general, it's also the willingness, you know, to work, the desire to work, and the willingness to move forward. And what's amazing about packaging and manufacturing in general, they are good jobs. They're good career, lifelong jobs. And I think there's this whole shift in the economy and the mindset of, you know, we have a lot of people going to get degrees that may not be applicable today, and it's really switching that tide to jobs that are applicable today. And so I think to your point, I think we have to look at different places to go recruit. I think we have to start changing the dialogue about working in manufacturing, and talk about how great a career it is. You know, we obviously are very involved in the academia for packaging, but beyond that, there's a lot of trade school activities. There's a lot of just certificate programs that need to be revitalized and energized to get the workforce into this market.
Well, the other thing that we're hearing from a lot of our customers, especially the larger ones competing with talent, is the need to modernize their operations too. Mm-hmm. You know, Ryan, we've talked a lot about equipment and machinery. Matthew, you talk a lot about things, tools like SpecWrite, spec data management, going in, not having people using spreadsheets. How does automation and technology impact this workforce challenge?
That is the thing that everyone's going to right now to fill in that gap. You know, we've seen that over the last 30 years, well, actually since 1987, so a little bit more, there's a 1% negative compound annual growth rate with box plant manufacturers. So we have almost a little over 25% fewer box plants this year than we'd had 30 years ago. We think that number is going to continue to drop. We've seen a lot of consolidation with International Paper and now Smurfit Westrock. You know, there are going to be more plant closures. The key management has even said this publicly, so it's not news to me anymore. But that workforce is almost 30% lower than it was 30 years ago. So it's outrunning even the number of box plants. And part of the reason that's happened is we have seen some automation, right? We have seen that where 30 years ago, it was commonplace to forklift sheets off of a corrugator. In new corrugators, everything's automated. It's going to be scheduled by software. In some cases, you know, Pratt Industries has a brand new facility in Texas. They even have automated forklifts. So it's almost like you have to do some of these things just to keep up. And more importantly, now we have machinery that can make up to 800 boxes a minute. You cannot feed a machine by hand that quickly. It will completely outrun you. So you have to have the automation just to keep up.
Yeah, the recapitalization of the packaging industry is amazing. You know, I was participating in that, invested hundreds of millions of dollars to revitalize and take our workforce to a very competitive level. But what's interesting is in the front office, there were still filing cabinets, right? And there was still, you know, hard-coded paper everywhere. And tremendous, you know, we didn't really impact the front end of the business at all. We impacted the back end, which was really important. But I think this, to your point, there's going to be a whole revolution that has to be on automating the front end. Why we live in the dark ages on the front end operation side of the business and we still do things the way they were done 30 years ago is amazing. That's going to have to change.
I want to bring it back to the tariffs really quickly. You know, Matthew, you are a longtime packaging supplier. How should suppliers get out in front of this? Because one of the things we've heard is retailers already saying we won't be passing on cost increases to customers. So, you know, this is going to cause disruption in general. How would you get out in front of this as a packaging person?
I think it's going to be near impossible to do it the way you're doing it. I think optionality. If you think about back to what I said, you got to dissect your product down to a very granular level. You need to know what your options are, where it can come from, what are your alternative methods or products that can be brought together at a lower cost. And you have to be able to calculate your product at the granular DNA level. You know, today, a lot of focus is on the BOM level. Like, what's the final cost me? Can I be compete in the market? And it's $2.50. I can sell it for $2.90. I'm in business. You have to understand the 250 better than you've ever understood today. And then the impact daily, you know, there's some information that people are pre-buying what they can. That only lasts so long. You know, capital's hard, space is hard. So that's not the answer. That may be a momentary answer. The bigger answer is let's dissect that $2.50 down at the penny.
Knowing what you have, looking at your options, and being prepared to just be agile, it sounds like planning for the unplanned.
Yeah, it's like a CrossFit thing. Prepare for the unpreparable or something like that?
Yeah. What a fun time. I want to shift gears. You know, Ryan, you've done so much amazing work around this corrugated box cost index. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and why you created it?
Yeah. So the industry is so much more vertically integrated today than it was 30 years ago. Now you have three producers who own about 65% of the space. If you start tacking on the kind of the four and five and six, it doesn't take long before you're at 80%. The top 10 are well over 80%. And because of that, there really isn't an open market anymore. I was just walking through this the other day with one of our clients, and it's somewhere between like 1.2 and 1.5 million tons a year of like actual open market, non-contracted purchases of container board. So if you're looking to that market to determine kind of what's happening in a commodity, why in the world would 5% be dominating the other 95%? It's ridiculous. And so if you were to think about a vertically integrated company, they have their own paper mill, they make the paper, they send it to their own plant, they turn it into a box. There's no real volatility there. The only volatility is in their costs. So our new index is an algorithm that shows a lot of their costs. It's completely transparent. It's a calculator by its nature. And because of that, it is, we don't like to use the word, but I'll use it for this purpose. It's forecastable. So if you wanted to run a price scenario for the future, half of those inputs have future markets. So you can begin to look at those future markets and see where they're going. The other two out of four, they don't necessarily have future markets, but they're linear up and to the right. So you can kind of extrapolate the data and see where they're going. The other two, we're actually working on putting together some future consensus or future markets on those. So we're hoping that in the long run, the really savvy business, if they really wanted to, they could even begin to hedge all of the inputs of this index. And then that way they can soften the blow for when prices need to go up, right? They're ready for it. They've been planning for it. And when prices are going down, they're also ready for it.
No, it makes perfect sense. Obviously, we're aligned in the everything you just said. It's kind of like buying a car based upon what a Peugeot costs.
Right.
That's a car, by the way.
No, but you mean, Matthew, I know data is something you've always relied on in your career in packaging, but that seems almost like the exception rather than the norm. How is something like this, if you were in the industry today, how would you think about using it?
Yeah, obviously I'm a big supporter of it. You know, data analytics, reality is what I lean on everything I do. It's an industry that's driven by history, right? And history kind of, to Ryan's point, doesn't make sense that you would let 5%, you know, dictate 95%. It's just logically not correct. So I would use this tool, and I would integrate this tool into my business planning. And, you know, corrugated, well, typically it's a smaller percentage of cost for companies. It depends on the product. It's still a cost nobody likes to pay, right? And always tries to reduce and avoid. But I think predictability is what business, which just takes us all the way back to the start of this conversation. Yeah. Predictability is what businesses need. Not emotion, not reaction to different things, but what's really going on in the world. And that's what Ryan's doing.
Awesome. How can people get in touch with you and work with you, Ryan?
Yeah. So you can find me on LinkedIn first. If you haven't done that, just search LinkedIn at Ryan Fox, is who I am. You can also email me at Ryan or rfox93@bloomberg.net. We can correspond that way. And, you know, we can talk about kind of what this index is. If you want to talk about the index, you can talk about our reporting. Happy to send out some samples and get people familiar with it.
Amazing. You know, I think in summary, plan for the unplanned, have optionality, get your data, get transparency, use other tools to create certainty even when you don't have some. Those are just some of my takeaways from today. Gentlemen, thank you both for this. We're now going to go to our segment of Off the Shelf with Matt Dingy. Let me pull it up really quickly. Now we'd like to welcome packaging consultant Matt Dingy to the pod for Off the Shelf. Matt joins us from Michigan State University's new Product Works collection, which features over 140,000 products from around the world, aiming to educate and inspire the next generation of packaging engineers. Matt, what product are we going to learn about today?
Hello, everyone. Today, we're looking at Pebico tooth powder. So we're going back in time when tooth powder was around, and I know it's making a comeback. And I'm holding here one package, which is in a metal container with a fitment with tooth powder in it, and its counterpart, which they transitioned to, which is a paperboard tooth powder package with a fitment as well. So two from the same time period, but different formats of the same product.
Matt, that's so cool. And Laura, I got to jump on this before you do. I didn't use that tooth powder. I know you always say I'm old, but I'm not that old. But what a cool, you know, that tin product, what a cool, I know that's coming back, that whole concept of value product packaging we talk about all the time, but it's interesting to see at some point there had to be an alternative value, you know, maybe it was a lower cost or something to put it in the fiberboard. What are your thoughts, Laura?
So I just have a question. Did tooth powder precede toothpaste? Wow. And the irony is, to your point, Matt, a few years ago, companies came out with tooth powder where you would add water to it and do it again. So in a way, we're kind of going back in time. You showed one packaging that said new wartime. What does it say? Let's look at that again.
Yeah. So for those listening, as Matthew was saying, they actually explain, it says on here, new wartime metal saving container. The same generous amount of tooth powder as in former metal container. So this is, again, right around the wartime. So they're obviously making a packaging change for a reason that we haven't had recently, but they're trying to conserve metal for the war. And so that drove them to this paperboard container.
We talk about supply chain issues today. They had them back then. Like, they're running out of metal because they're using it for wartime activities. So they had to change the industrial or, you know, consumer products back to as paperboard. That's pretty cool.
That's amazing. Well, I'm so excited for everyone to watch this, and maybe a few people get a few ideas. I know we have some CPG companies on here. It's a good reminder that, you know, the past becomes the future. And I think toothpaste, especially, it's one of those categories where you think, how could it be different? But there are so many different vehicles around oral care in general. So cool to see it go from tin to paperboard to today's tubes, and now back essentially in a way. So Matt, thank you so much for joining us for Off the Shelf. We'll see you next time.
Great. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Ryan, thank you for being with us here today.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone.